This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, it must be the weather. How nature reflects art in speculative fiction.
So this week, Jules and I are being very, very British.
Yes. I have my cup of tea here.
You have your cup of tea.
My cup of tea.
Before the episode started, Jules said, right, I'm just going to go make my cup of tea, as that seems rather appropriate. And I'm like, that's never been a thing before, Jules. You always go and make a cup of tea.
To which I said, yes, but we're discussing the weather, so I have an excuse.
What's the weather like over where you are, Jules?
It's absolutely gorgeous today. It's really bright and clear and very crisp and cold. So we had frost this morning, but it's a lovely clear day.
Same over here. Not too cold. I mean, it has been pretty cold. And apparently it is going to get a little bit colder. But by the time this episode airs, who knows, perhaps it'll be Saharan, you know. I don't know.
That's a bit hopeful for Britain, isn't it?
It is a little bit hopeful for Britain. though we wouldn't survive Sahara weather, really. We wouldn't. We're not equipped for the heat at all. But we are equipped for the cold. So actually, it's been rather nice. It's nice and sunny. I quite like it. But of course, we're not just talking about the weather in general. We're going to be looking at how the weather is used in books and films, and the link with character emotion. So we're going to be looking at a little bit of pathetic fallacy, and also how it can link in with themes and feelings and things along those lines. So Jules, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, I will do. I suppose the thing with the weather is, like many things, I think one of the things that the tricks you have to get used to as a writer is using chains of association and using them correctly. And obviously there are some chains of association that are redundant now and need to be retired because they're actually harmful, but we won't talk about those.
Yeah.
But the weather's a good one because there are so many different ways you can portray something. I mean, as you said before yourself, there's only so many ways you can say a character's really angry.
Yeah.
Or have them display it. So what you can do is have the things that are going on around the character, the sort of things the character would notice, enhancing what they're feeling. So perhaps they're feeling angry, and instead of noticing that it's a lovely summer's day, they notice how sultry the heat is and how it's making everybody quite tense and short-tempered.
Yeah.
So what they're noticing is their own tendency towards anger at that moment in someone else.
Yeah.
And it's really, really helpful. So one example is the Circle series by Tamora Pierce, for example. She's got one book in that quartet called, sometimes it's called Triss's book, because there's four main characters and Triss is one of them, and sometimes it's called The Power in the Storm. And that entire book is basically one big thunderstorm, almost. I mean, it's set over a period of time, but there are pirates invading the cove, and they intend to take over, you know, Winding Circle Temple, which is where these four children are fostered.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all looking quite grim. There's been earthquakes because someone else has been hoarding magic further along the coast and pushing the earthquakes along, so a really big earthquake's on the way. And there's this sense of impending threat and storm all the time. And it starts off with this really intense heat and humidity and nobody can sleep. Everyone's a bit short-tempered and on edge. And then the pirates turn up in the cove. And it's just the internal conflict and the external conflict and the atmosphere around it is represented really well in the weather.
Yeah.
And what she does really well then is she feeds it into the next couple of books. So you can see where everything's sort of built up. So in the same way that one season feeds into another, how the weather is in one book into another sort of feeds into the final problem in the fourth book.
Yeah. And you know, it's a bit cliche, but you cannot ignore the visual element as well.
No.
I mean, there is something very visual. I mean, whether you imagine a funeral, okay,
Yeah.
you think of a funeral in a film, and what is it? It's raining, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
Yeah.
raining, and people have got the black umbrellas and stuff like that. Or it's a
Yeah.
very sort of quiet, peaceful one where the sun is shining. And it depends. Are you trying to give like a hopeful feel of justice has been served, or this is a peaceful day? You know, in
It's
cop
quite
dramas, you
poignant.
get it all the time. Like, we got our guy, but our friend still died, and then they go and have it, and
Yeah.
there's, you know, things like that. You get it all the time.
I mean, rain's an interesting one. That's something I actually did in a short story. I had the character's new husband died, and she actually says in the short story, "I remember the day of the funeral as raining, and my memory lies because I know it was bright sunlight the whole time, and the blackbirds were singing, but in her head it was raining, it
It
was
was
pouring
raining.
out the sky."
Yeah.
So you can use the weather to be a complete juxtaposition to how the character feels, so it's jarring as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is true, that does actually happen. You can sort of remember sort of the weather. I'm trying to think of all the funerals I've been to, and as far as it is in my head, that it was raining on every single one of them. Even though I know for a fact that it wasn't
No.
it wasn't raining. But yeah, and it is that visual element, you know, the sky is crying. And it's when the elements and the weather echo, sort of take on human characteristics. So when, you know, thunderstorms, when you're angry, the characteristic of a thunderstorm, you know, is it's loud, and people who are angry are loud, and the lightning, and they lash out. All right. When you're happy and chirpy, your face brightens up, you're smiling, you're warm, and so you add that sort of to a sunny thing. You have birds singing, it makes you think of that chirpiness. All right. When you're sad, you have the rain, because it makes you know, it's tears. And it's when the weather itself becomes character, or becomes an extension of the character. And I really like what you said earlier on about actually how that can then be turned on its head, because you can have a nice warm day, but the character can, in the way that the character interprets it, changes the way that it's read
Yeah.
by the readers. So rather than it being a warm day, it's a hot, sticky day. You know, you feel lethargic, you feel irritable immediately. It's a genius way of doing it, and it's a genius way of setting emotions and setting the scene. And it only takes a very, very small amount of time to do it, which is,
Yeah.
I was actually talking about this, you know, with my class. We were talking about show, don't tell. And the first few exercises I got them to do was to show, don't tell emotions. And they got on with that very, very easily. And I said, so show a character being happy, show a character being sad. And, you know, that was very easy. They just described people, you know, laughing or crying or things like that. And then I said, remake the sentence so it's show, don't tell. It was raining outside. And a few of them actually really struggled with it, because it was the first time that they thought about how they could show the weather rather than just telling the weather. And how you show the weather will change the perception and the general mood of the story entirely,
Yeah.
because it's how it's interpreted. So if you have rain pattering against a window, it's kind of soothing, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly if you're inside and you're warm and you don't have to go outside, it's the contrast, isn't it?
Yeah, but then it just very simply changed the word. Rain was lashing against the window, the wind howling close by. Suddenly a menacing presence, isn't there? Like
Yeah.
something trying to get in. And it's a very, very small change, but it's exactly the same kind of weather, but the interpretation changes the mood entirely. And I just think that's really interesting, how we characterize the weather and how we interpret it as human beings.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's have a look at a few of them then. A good one for me is the mist coming down in The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, which is actually, I mean, it's very definitely, the mist is being, if you're thinking of Alderley Edge, so it's rocky, it's a bit remote.
Yeah.
Certainly back in the 1960s when this was set. And, you know, it's quiet, night is coming, it's all getting dark. There are big sinkholes in the ground, and if you fall in one or one of the old mine shafts, there's a good probability you're not coming out again. And you have these two children wandering along Alderley Edge trying to find their way home, and they get lost in the mist. And obviously, the Svart Alfar are coming out of the hob holes in the ground because Susan's carrying something that the forces of darkness want. And you can see it's really very visual, even with my rather poor description of it there. It's a really visual thing. And I've always liked mist and fog used as something where one of the characters being deceived, or they're not seeing something, they're blinding themselves to something that's obvious, or that it's a sense of mystery, you know, that there are things there that aren't really meant for them to know.
Yeah. And mist is an interesting one, actually.
Yes.
The relationship between mist and magic, I just want to discuss that a little bit. Because out of all of the kind of the elemental things that you get, mist does seem to be the most magical, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's the amorphous nature of it as well, isn't it? It's not really one thing, it's not really the other. It's water and air. And
it's secretive. It's secretive because it hides things. And you can't see what's beyond. And it has, and as you say, it has that sort of quite shifting nature, which means that you can both see and you can't see through it. It can create illusions. And it also has that way of dampening sound.
Yeah, I mean, depending on where you use it in a story, it can be really quite eerie or even frightening. Thinking of Stephen King's The Mist, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And so you see kind of mist being used a lot, actually, in fantasy, especially fantasy which involves mythology.
Yes.
Because there's the other thing about mist, which is it has this sense of time or timelessness.
Yeah, there's a sort of bridging effect, isn't there?
Yeah.
As if you're crossing from one world to another,
yeah.
She says, knowing full well she's used it herself for that reason.
No, but you know, that's what it evokes. Because there's also the sense of the fact that you go into the mist and you can't necessarily see whether, if it's, you're completely surrounded by mist, you don't necessarily know what time it is. You lose all depth of perception because you don't have anything to kind of to use in order to kind of stabilize yourself. So you lose your depth of perception because everything is white and just seems to go on and on. Sound becomes weird and echoes around you in an odd way. You start seeing things, okay? It's difficult to know how long you've been in there. It can be quite panicky. I mean, I've been up in the mountains and we've been going through mist. Well, it was really cloud, to be honest. And it was on a day that it was cast over. And I was skiing, so it was white snow, white everything. We couldn't see more than sort of 3 meters in front of us. And there were avalanches going off close by. And we could just hear this avalanche, the crumbling snow, all right. And I had no idea which direction it was in. I didn't know what was up or down. It was really scary. And I don't know, you know, as far as I was concerned, I was in that mist for hours. And I know I wasn't in the mist for hours, but it felt like hours. And so you see mist in things like the Mist of Avalon. You see them in the Keystone one. Did I say that right?
I've got no idea which one you mean, I'm afraid.
No, sorry, the one you just mentioned, the Weird Stone.
The Weird Stone. Oh,
the Weird
Stone,
not Keystone. And it does appear, and obviously you see it in Unveiled as well. And you know, even the sayings, the mists of time and stuff like that, that's what where the association really is. And it's a really interesting characteristic, and if used properly, it can either, you know, it can be cliche, but if used properly, it can also be very evocative.
Yeah, definitely. I'm
Sorry,
going back.
I'm
Sorry,
getting
Kat.
really into this.
I'm
We're
really
talking
into
about the weather, and I'm just there like, oh, my time has
it.
come.
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah. Our natural Britishness is coming forward. It's funny, though, because you can say mist and it means one thing, and you can say fog, which is really heavy mist, and actually it means something completely different. Fog for me always is evocative of, a ship out at sea not being able to find the coast, and you might hear fog bells or the fog horn or something, and there's something very eerie about that, depending on where you're standing.
I think of fog sort of out at sea, or I think of fog in like ye old London, like Victorian London. I think of fog or smog.
Yeah. Oh,
Real
the old
pea
pea
super.
soupers.
So
Yeah,
yeah.
actually, I mean, that to be fair, I did use that in, okay, it's not ready for anyone to read yet, but I mentioned the prequel series I'm doing with Mary Cranford,
Yes.
Nay Riley, and one of her early adventures that I might give away as a freebie sets her in the Killing Fog in London during the 1950s.
Jesus.
So yeah, you'll have to see. But yeah, it's the same sort of thing. There's so much you can do with the weather, and it sounds like it's a really boring topic, but actually it's really not.
No, it isn't. And I think it's the fact that people don't realize the power of the weather in books. And they don't realize actually the effect they can have, because you know I talk about pathetic fallacy in my classes, and everyone thinks it's a very old thing to do. Oh, pathetic fallacy. Oh, that means, you know, like you've got to have the gothic, the thunder outside and the wind is howling and the maiden runs across in her white dress, shrieking as blood runs from the walls. You know, it
The
doesn't
highwaymen
happen.
came riding.
The highwaymen came riding. There was a skull on the porch. Someone was murdered. Someone was insane. There was an incestuous union somewhere along the way. It's not. It doesn't have
Really
to
want you
be.
to write that book. I'm so there for that. Do it very slightly sarcastically so no one can tell whether you mean it or not.
Challenge accepted. But yeah, no, it doesn't have to be like that. And you actually see a trend at the moment of people doing the complete opposite. So having very, very sad days, but saying it was bright and sunny and thinking, oh, it shouldn't be bright and sunny. And they think, ha ha, yes, I'm breaking the trend now. I'm doing things realistically. But actually, you're still using the weather in that way, because it's recognizing how we react to weather and what it does to us.
Yeah, definitely. And it's as you were saying about thunderstorms earlier, on its most primitive level, that would suggest thunder and certain sorry, it would suggest thunder. It suggests thunder and lightning and anger at a very base level. But obviously you can change that and twist that, and it really depends what you want to link it to. Do you want to link it to a sense of foreshadowing? Do you want to link it to character and action and emotion, or do you want to link it to theme? And it's really interesting. And I think some of the most effective ones are when you compile it all together, so it's linking to every single one of them. I don't. Okay, I feel a bit bad sort of using my own example, but with I Hold the Tide, the whole thing's w that build up to one big storm. And I've tried to do the same thing there. And it's not so much about anger, but it's about something cataclysmic being revealed.
Yes. Sorry. All of this talk of storms and things like that, it's made me remember my favorite line in Macbeth.
Oh,
If I may, I'd
yes,
just like
please
to
do.
read this small extract. So you have Lennox, who says, The night has been unruly. Where we lay, our chimneys were blown down, and as they say, lamentings heard in the air, strange screams of death, and prophesying with accents terrible of dire combustions and confused events, new hatched to the woeful time, the obscure bird clamoured the livelong night. Some say the earth was feverous and did shake. And then Macbeth goes, 'Twas a rough night. Which is just my favourite thing in the entire play, because it was just this great build-up of Lennox, you know, building this image on stage, which is so vivid and evokes so many different characteristics which we associate with fear and with bad things. So the obscure bird is the owl screeching in the night, you know, the earth shaking, you know, earthquakes, feverous, you know, fever, sickness, all of these natural occurrences, the wind sort of blowing down chimneys and causing these screaming sounds, these sounds of grief. All of these natural things which have been being associated with things which we connect with bad things. And it builds it up and builds it up and builds it up. And then Macbeth, who's obviously just murdered a man, it's just like, yeah. Yeah, it was pretty rough night.
Master of the understatement.
Master of the understatement. Like, I guess it was pretty bad.
So you don't need to be hysterical about it. The line I really like is sound and fury signifying nothing. And it's just one of the greatest put-downs in Shakespeare.
Yeah. He did have some pretty good put-downs. But yeah, that was my favourite weather-related Shakespeare quote, which just makes me happy every time. Anyway, but yeah, it is all about how we associate. And the storms as well. Now I've got, I say it's a personal question, it's not that personal, but, you know, how do storms make you feel, Jules?
Really energised?
Yeah?
I've always loved thunderstorms. I've never really understood how people can be frightened of them, but I know some people find thunder and lightning a bit frightening, haha. sorry, I went into queen mode there. I really apologise.
Had to be done, it had to be done.
Yeah, no, I really like them. I'd be out in them if I could. I know it's not sensible to be, say, out in a thunderstorm if the lightning's right overhead. It's certainly not sensible to be out under a tree, for example.
No. Do not.
Although, if there's a choice between lightning striking you and a tree, you want it to go for the tree every time.
Yeah, though you don't want to be standing where the roots are, because it'll go through the tree.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, it's... I'm fascinated by thunderstorms, but I am actually a little frightened of them and have been ever since I was little. As in, I love seeing them, but the loud noises, it jars me in a way. It makes me feel like there is something significantly more powerful. I get the same feeling, you know, like when I see the sea as well. I see something which is totally beyond my control, bigger and more powerful than me, this force of nature. And I'm kind of cowed by it. Is that the right word, cowed?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with approaching something with a bit of respect. I mean, I love mountains, but I'd be quite respectful about climbing them in the sense of, you know, the mountain doesn't really care if I'm there or not.
Yeah.
So it'll still kill me.
The mountain has one motivation, to be a mountain. That's it. Doesn't care about you, doesn't care about anything. Everest doesn't care about how many dead bodies there are at the top of it.
That can never be retrieved. The same with K2 or, you know, the Eiger, the North Face. It's amazing and it's humbling, and it should stay a bit humbling as well, I think.
Yeah.
Obviously, I love the sea, but I'm extremely respectful of the sea, not least because I nearly drowned once. I was 5 and I got swept out to sea at Weymouth. Don't recommend that, by the way.
No. Yeah, no, I think that, yeah, it's about... It's about nature and again how we treat it and how it's done. And yeah, I think if treated well within fiction, it's a very, very powerful mood builder. Now, I wanted to talk specifically about one. Well, I say I did. It was Jules. You were the one who suggested it. But a series which has actually been using the weather and the seasons quite prominently, and that is, of course, Game of Thrones.
Yes. Game of Thrones is a little bit different. It's very much the seasons and the weather associated are linked intrinsically to the theme and also to what's the action that's happening. And it's obviously quite slow because, you know, they're big books, and the seventh book should be out sometime 2020, I think he's now said.
Seriously?
Yeah, apparently. And there's an eighth one after that.
Oh, come on.
Anyway, you've got the fact that the seasons, particularly the great seasons like summer and winter, which is the ones they're really looking at, there doesn't seem, have you noticed there doesn't really seem to be an autumn or a spring? It's just summer and winter.
Yeah.
But anyway, that the great seasons can last years, even decades. So this whole, the winter is coming, is the fact, yes, winter will always come, and whatever world they're on in Game of Thrones, ultimately, you know that there might be decades of winter. So you can be born as a summer child and grow up, spend all your life basically in summer with like petty winters, if you like.
Yeah.
Or petty changes of the seasons, but predominantly your years are ruled by summer. And then suddenly winter comes and it's like, it's snow and everyone's dying and people are strangling their own children so they don't listen to them, starving to death.
Yeah. It's pretty dark. And then of course, and then the monsters come.
Yes, and it's very much the White Walkers, as they're called in the TV series, are very much linked to the fact that winter is coming, and they need the cold as well.
Yeah.
And I suppose the thing that's always amused me is that they're all like bickering over politics and who gets to sit on this throne. Meanwhile, this huge zombie army is marching inevitably down south as winter arrives.
Yep, and the only one who cares is Jon Snow, who is one of the significant and main characters of the series, and is literally named after a weather.
Yes.
I'm not sure that that George R. R. Martin did that on purpose, but it is quite telling, is that he's named after this weather, which is associated with the winter, and he's the one who brings the warning of winter and what that entails.
Yeah, it's just a really interesting way that it's done, in the sense of you might have petty seasons within various years, but the actual years themselves are ruled by summer or winter.
Yeah,
and it's it makes an interesting backdrop to the series. I imagine that bit was done very much deliberately.
But yeah.
Talking about snow,
mm-hmm.
and I know I'm leaping around a little bit here, but that kind of leads us to fairy tales.
Yes, let's talk about fairy tales.
Because, okay, and various different types of weather, but fairy tales, when they're told traditionally, generally don't have an awful lot of detail as to setting and things. So if anything that's put in as to do with the seasons or weather is really important, and it means more than just the fact that it was raining that day or it was really cold in the woods. And it's generally the same as saying, you know, the main character, who might be a princess, probably was a princess, is very beautiful, mm-hmm. or you might say she's very good. The two things, beauty and goodness, are almost inextricably linked all the time. It's, again, these chains of association, it's shorthand.
Yeah.
So if we take Snow White, for example, the fact that, okay, yes, Snow White is very evocative in the sense of, you know, what colour her skin was. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, snow is also associated with purity and with innocence and with there being a dearth of experience. It's a tabula rasa state. It changes everything.
Yeah. It is interesting because it's that way of looking and interpreting weather and looking at what it signifies, because there's obviously a big difference when we think of a snowstorm and when we think of just snow.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, snow coming down might mean one thing, a real flurry or a blizzard even.
Yeah.
And also it depends on where you are as well. I mean, I can't see snow coming down in a town without suddenly feeling like it's Dickens. which is, you know, it's Dickens and it's Christmas. And the thing is, it's really, that's quite unlikely in terms of combinations, isn't it? We talk about a white Christmas over here, but it's actually really unusual.
It's snowing, you're like, oh, you look up, you see the snow coming down, and then you look down again, and the whole town has just become Victorian. There are people passing by in petticoats.
Does that not happen to you? Is that just me?
Jules, get your head checked. Go to a hospital. But
I'm
but snow does have that, does evoke that that sense of purity, that sense of new beginnings. But it also, interestingly enough, it evokes the theme of slumber.
Yeah, it can be slumber. It can also be loss and grief. Yeah. And I think the thing in Snow White is we're supposed to feel that, you know, there's part of her that's sort of shut down because her mother's gone.
Yeah.
And she hasn't really had any sort of affection or guidance from anybody. Mm. So, you know, you have the Wicked Queen, and we assume that's not a healthy relationship.
Yeah,
and
she's not great as a mother figure.
Her father literally turns up in that fairy tale to father her and then marry someone else, and that's it. He has no further agency. And some of it will be the Disney aesthetic as well.
Yeah.
In the sense of, we see her in the Disney film disappearing off into the woods, and it's dark and it's frightening, etc., right up until the point where we discover it's not quite so bad because there's the dwarfs there and all the animals and all the flowers and things come out. And
yeah.
But then you've got that very sort of traditional from winter into spring type feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. And which is this new beginning, but not just the new beginning. The snow also represents childhood in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Because when the snow melts and the summer begins, that's the transition between childhood to being an adult. And that's exactly what happens to her. You know, she goes to sleep like the ground, which has been covered in the snow, and she's kissed and she's woken up and she's gone, and she rises up. And she's gone from being the slumbering child, the seed which was just planted before the snow fell, and sort of flowers and becomes an adult.
Yeah, it is definitely a metaphor for burgeoning sexuality and, you know, female fertility as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's if you read the most innocent versions of the fairy tale.
Yeah.
The really, really original pre-Grimm version of Snow White is extremely disturbing and is more to do with necrophilia, but perhaps we won't touch on that.
Yeah, well, we're not going to touch on that yet. Not today.
I suppose the other one that it makes me think of is Hansel and Gretel. Not snow, but they're, you know, led off into this autumn wood.
Yeah.
Because they're facing a winter. And the family's obviously hungry, and you have the most weak-willed, spineless father figure in that.
Yeah.
With a stepmother, again. Let's get rid of the children. At least she didn't suggest eating them, like happens in some of the fairy tales. Yeah, because that's a thing. And, you know, they're hungry, they're in the woods, and things are looking bad. So you've got autumn as a time of, generally that's a time of family coming together. So the real juxtaposition there is the fact the children are being cast out into the woods.
Yeah.
Into a state.
Yeah.
But they're going to be more hungry, and then obviously finding the gingerbread cottage.
Yes.
We all know what happened from there.
Yes, we do. Okay, so I had a book I was going to mention. And I don't remember what it is. Oh, it wasn't a book. Sorry. I wanted to talk about Frozen.
Yes.
Because Frozen is a Christmas film. Yeah, it was released at Christmas. And it has all the Christmas aesthetic. The snow and stuff. And the reindeer. But it's set in summer.
Yes.
Which is quite interesting. Because, you know, they didn't have to set it in summer. I guess the reason they set it in summer was to create that juxtaposition between Elsa and Anna.
Yeah.
With Anna being Sama, right down to the way she looks, and Elsa being winter, right down to the way she looks. So Anna has those, you know, freckles. She's a little bit more tanned. She's got the auburn hair. She wears green and bright colours. Whereas Elsa, I think she wears green and bright colours, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does.
Yeah.
It's quite warm and spring type colours, whereas obviously Elsa's in very cool colours.
Yeah, and I mean, Elsa begins in very, if I remember, she does wear obviously she changes into her lovely kind of thingy dress, but her coronation dress, so the clothes that we see her in before, again, cool colours, but cool and dark,
yeah,
as well. So she has that. She has the purple cloak, but she's wearing black, gold, and a sort of a dark teal or turquoise, which doesn't evoke summer. It has a very wintry kind of feel to it in a lot of ways, and then that's abandoned, but it also has this sense of control beneath it. And then obviously that's abandoned for the clothes that she then turns into with the long, you know, blue icicle stuffs. Sorry, that's the best way I would describe it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it is very different. And that's why you have the summer and then you have the winter, the two put together. And obviously it's about a kind of a change and the sort of the permeation of winter into the heart of summer.
Yeah, I mean, Frozen's interesting in the sense of that it's a direct parallel of Elsa's character journey, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
As in, her power completely gets away from her and she runs away from her responsibility, quite understandably.
Yeah.
But the fact that she's running away from it means she's completely shifted the balance the wrong way. So, and all the way through, you've got Anna trying to get Elsa to come back. So it's a case of, no, you are necessary, but, you know, in the same sort of moderation that I'm necessary, we balance each other.
Yeah, they do. And together they create something which ultimately works, which is what is shown at the end. Summer is restored, but there is no longer this negative connotation that comes with the winter.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And I liked the way that it was used. I mean, as a film, you know, there have been complaints and things like that. I enjoyed it. And I like the way that they use the seasons, and I like the way that they use the weather in that. Specifically in the way that they use the blizzards to show anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Which I thought was really, really nice, because it connected a lot of the sort of the other kinds of weathers that we get. So the howling wind, you know, comes in with fear, the mist, which comes in with this sense of timelessness and lack of direction, and the kind of the circular, you know, the coldness of it all, the confusion. It was really, really well done, the way they used that to signify the internal kind of conflict that was happening, and so that we could see it in an external way. And having characters who are in control of the weather like that, and the weather being affected by their mood, is a great way of really putting a visual on that mood.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, the other version of that is Thor Ragnarok.
Yes.
When Thor gets angry, the lightning comes, though.
Yeah, that's not so much a metaphor as an anvil, isn't it?
I'm not saying that Thor's a Disney princess, but Thor is a Disney princess.
He certainly could be.
So, yeah.
Okay, another one, moving away from the cold and moving on to something a bit more sort of cataclysmic. There's part in The Stand, and it's only a really small bit. So The Stand by Stephen King. Mm-hmm. I've mentioned it before, so I'm sure everybody who listens regularly already knows that 99.9% of the human population is killed by the superflu in The Stand. and the rest of the survivors all sort of try and come together. And during all this, there's the conflict between those who are going towards Mother Abigail, looking to create a society that is going to be a bit more balanced, and you have people who have faults, but they're generally good people, and the people who, they're not bad, but they've kind of left things like empathy out of their day-to-day worldview, and they end up being drawn to the Dark Man.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there's this bit in the stand. Obviously, the Dark Man wants to rule everything, and he's one of the most insidious and terrifying characters ever. Nick is he's a deaf mute, and he is on his own for days. He's cycling across America trying to find anybody else alive.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes across Tom Cullen, and Tom Cullen is in his early 50s, probably, and he's retarded, is how he's described. He's described as lightly retarded, so he's just got this he's quite childlike, and he can do a certain amount of looking after himself, but more complex ideas he has difficulty with. He has difficulty with inducting and deducting in order to reason. Nick's like, kind of like, oh god, he's going to be difficult to look after, particularly since I can't actually talk to him and he can't read.
Yeah.
But I can't leave him behind. So they both cycle off together. And after a day when, they kind of have a minor disagreement, but they keep going, and then they stop for the evening, and basically Tom panics and has Nick running after him. And Nick can't understand what it is, what the matter is. He's been feeling this sort of low anxiety all the day, and he's not really sure why. And what it is there's a huge tornado. But of course, he's deaf, he can't hear it.
Right.
And it's one of those ones where he's not native to Kansas, so he's not familiar with the way the clouds and things change when a tornado is about to touch down. But Tom, for all the fact that he has severe learning difficulties, knows what a tornado is.
Yeah.
And actually manages to save Nick's life by, saying, hey, there's a tornado there, and dragging him into a storm cellar.
Yeah.
But it's the whole parallel between this tornado just touching down out of nowhere and this figure, the Dark Man, who's clearly looking for them, looking for anyone who's trying to escape his influence.
Yeah.
And they're in the storm cellar, and the door keeps sort of flapping open and showing a bit of the storm outside and closing again. And there's this feeling in the dark that someone else is in the dark with them.
Yeah.
And the parallel between the two is really, really good. Bit terrifying, but adds to the overall menace of the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is actually... I've never actually seen an example of that. Well, I probably have. I just can't think of it right now. But an example of the weather being used as a watchful eye.
Yeah, you kind of get a little bit like that in Lord of the Rings, but it's not really the weather, is it? It's kind of just this feeling.
It is this actually giant watchful eye.
Well, yeah, there is a giant watchful eye as well. Sort of the eye is turned upon us, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. I like that, actually. I might have to. I really do have to read it now, don't I?
What, the stand?
Yeah.
I'd recommend it to everyone, but I think there are going to be vast chunks of that you probably don't like very much. Don't you read it?
I will definitely have to check it out.
Okay, final thing, I suppose. Rivers.
And
in particular, the Amazon. Obviously not the delivery service. the original Amazon. In the Amazon jungle, the Amazon basin, it's sometimes called the River Sea because it is so wide. It is such a huge, huge river.
Yeah.
I'm only going to talk about this one briefly, but there are two books, and they're both by the same author, Eva Ibbotson, and one is The Journey to the River Sea, and the other one is A Company of Swans.
Yeah.
And basically, in both of them, they're both set around sort of 1910, 1920,
mm-hmm.
and one's a children's book and one's a young adult, but basically the main character, a girl in both cases, through various circumstances, ends up going out from England and living in the Amazon. And we say in the Amazon, we think, oh, they're living in tree houses and things, which is, obviously not right. There was a city out there. There was a big town during the time of the rubber barons. Mm-hmm. And I know there's lots of bad stuff that goes with that. And the books do go into it, so I won't. There was a city for people who were out there literally making millions, making huge amounts of wealth. It was a popular thing for second sons to do. We still had the aristocracy, the great fool of the upper classes hadn't really happened over here yet then. Houses were still being gambled away by dissolute elder sons, for example. But it was a good thing for disinherited second sons to do. Mm. And they'd make a lot of money, and they'd fall in love with the land and build big plantation houses out there. And it wasn't all about slavery and things either, I would like to say. There were willing and happy partnerships on both sides. But what's really interesting is that these two particular characters that I'm thinking of in these books that go out there, they're both, I suppose they're both emotionally deprived. One of them in particular, this is really bad, I can't remember her name. I'm going to get the book off the shelf a second. Because Harriet in A Company of Swans, mm-hmm. she wants to, there's a ballet company that has offered her a place and she'd like to go out there. Mm-hmm. Because that's where they're going to perform. There's actually an opera house out there. I think it's still there.
All right, yeah.
Obviously, she's not allowed to. But she's been, you know, her mother died when she was young. Her father's very cold and remote. He's an Oxford dean. And her aunt is just this awful, miserly woman. And she's just been deprived of, you know, emotional nourishment all her life. And I love the way that the river, the Amazon itself, is kind of used as this huge gulf of emotional gifts she has that she is there for her to use, but that she can't do it without actually getting out there in the first place, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So but it is kind of an adventure for her, and there's a sort of love affair and things that potentially goes wrong. But the whole time, the river is kind of a metaphor for her emotional state and the fact that she's becoming more than she was before, more than this like very thin, stunted life she had.
Yeah. Rivers are actually interesting, and let's talk about water in general for a little bit, because we mentioned mist.
Yeah.
But water and the way it's used, so rivers, the sea, rain, I think the fact that they are so changeable probably is what gives them, allows us to sort of apply a lot, so much character to them, because they're changeable in the way that we're changeable. So we have, you know, the sea, talking about Moana, for instance. There's a really nice line, which is, I like how the sea misbehaves in the song.
Yeah.
It misbehaves, and it does. It has this character, which is quite light but caring and very powerful. And obviously, the sea is very is this extension of Moana herself, and who she is, and it holds within it that dangerous side, and the stubborn side, the slightly mischievous side, because we're seeing it through her experience. And the way she reacts to it, the sea, she and the sea seem to be bound together. So you have the river as well. Excuse the pun, but water is very reflective.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, some of them completely unconsciously, have used water or vast bodies of water as reflection of character, emotion, definitely.
Yeah.
Again, I've sort of used that in Amy's academical. She's on Lake Geneva.
Yeah.
And there's the whole secret in the lake, but there's the secret that Amy's discovering about herself as well at the same time. So It's a really handy bit of shorthand for writers, definitely.
Yeah. But no less powerful, actually. If done correctly, it really is actually a very powerful tool to have. I think we're actually running out of time, Jules.
Yeah, we've come to the end there, really. If we didn't mention your favourite type of weather, we do apologise.
We're very sorry.
We'd just rather talk about rain and snow and stuff.
Two British people can talk about the weather for an hour. All right, then. Well, before we go, it's time for the Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, Jules has got one for you. Jules?
I've just finished an advanced copy of To Kill a Kingdom, which is absolutely brilliant. It's a standalone novel and it's a reimagination of A Little Mermaid, except that this character has so much agency. It's amazing. She's not a mermaid, she's a siren, and she's been taught since her earliest memories to be a killer of men, more specifically a killer of princes. The other side of the narrative is Prince Elion, who's the reluctant heir to the King of Midas, who doesn't really want to be king and spends most of his time hanging out with his crew on his pirate ship, or hanging out on his ship, living the life of a pirate, who has earned himself the reputation as Siren Killer. Sirens and humans are actually mortal enemies in this in this book. So the two main characters start out from the position of, we need to kill each other, and they're aware of each other, and they definitely have a target on each other.
Yeah.
And then Lyra, who is the main character, the siren, misbehaves, and her mother, the sea queen, who is very, you know, very like the sea witch from Disney's The Little Mermaid, punishes her by turning her into a human and telling her that she must steal the heart of the prince, as in literally his heart out of his chest. Because that's how sirens kill. They lure you into the water and then they rip your heart out. And they're required to do it at least once a year in the month of their birth and present it as tribute to the queen.
Sweet.
Lyra does something wrong. And her mother says, right, well, if you think you're good enough to be the next sea queen, you can do it in human form. Off you go. So they're on a collision course. These are two characters who are not nice characters particularly to start with. They're definitely anti-heroes and they're on a collision course. And there's this serious A-grade banter going on. And someone somewhere complained that it was insta-love. It really isn't. They don't hate each other. They intend to kill each other. You know, they're serious about it. It's not a case of, oh, I'm going to kill him. Oh, but he smells so good. And everything goes out the window. It's like, no, I'm going to kill him. I can kind of see he's got a few good points, but I'm still going to kill him. Kind of thing. I've got every intention of literally pulling his heart out of his chest. And it's amazing and it's really aesthetically beautiful as well. So it's definitely one to read.
I will put it on my to be read list as well. And I hope you guys do as well. Thanks very much for listening. Do leave us a comment and remember you can get in contact with us via Facebook or on Twitter. And we will catch up with you guys next week. Till then, bye bye.
Thanks and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.